Iceland's economy came to a screeching halt in October 2008 when its banking sector collapsed. On today's first underreported segment, we discuss the efforts of the International Monetary Fund to rescue its economy and look into why a national debate has broken out over a deal to pay off the country's creditors. Joining me now is Landon Thomas Jr., financial correspondent for the New York Times, based in London, and I'm pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Last week, the Icelandic parliament passed a deal to recapitalize the three of its banks that failed last fall, giving control of two of them to creditors. How much money is the government putting into these banks?
It's not all that much. I think it's about $1 billion or so in bonds, compared to the kind of money that's been put into the big banks in New York and London, not much. But relative to the economy, it's quite a lot.
Well, how important a step is this for recovery?
It's important because the banks were at the center of the whole crisis. They became combined 8 or 9 times greater than the size of the economy. You have to remember that the economy is about $10 billion, which is about half of the losses of Citigroup last year, and these banks just became just huge, and so we're operating all over the world, collecting money from all over the world. So they really, it was the epicenter of the crisis, the over-leveraging of the bank. So the first thing to do was go after the banks, and then they had to deal with the economy, which is where the issue now is residing.
How did the over-leveraging that Iceland's three banks did differ from what Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns were doing here?
Not all that much. I mean, primarily they weren't lending money to they weren't doing the securitized mortgage game so much as they were just collecting money all over the world. The traditional way that a bank, responsible bank, manages its business is takes its deposits and lends to its borrowers. But Iceland's so small that they had to go all over the world to get funds, and then they just lent like crazy and bought like crazy. The essence of the crisis really was going out to the UK and opening up these ISAVE accounts where they were offering very lucrative interest rates, and then got $5 or $6 billion worth of deposits. And then when that all collapsed, they were on the hook for this money, and they couldn't pay it back, which is how they had to sort of take a loan from the UK.
So they didn't have the kind of insurance that we have, the
not
FDIC?
Not enough, no. I mean, in theory, on paper, they were responsible for it, but then when everything collapsed, they just didn't have it. It's as if, you take what happened in the U.S. and multiply it by a factor of 50 or 100, whereby there just wasn't enough. All the banks collapsed. And everyone asked for the money at the same time, there wouldn't be enough money to pay it back. And that never really happens, because generally people step in at the last second. But in Iceland, it happened. So it really is one of the few cases where everything failed. And it shows that it really is a confidence game. And so even though they were supposed to pay it back, they couldn't. And so the UK and the Dutch governments had to repay the depositors, but then they're forcing Iceland to pay them back, which is why it's called ICE slave in Iceland, because there's such animosity and sort of a revival of nationalistic fervor about repaying the British and the Dutch because of the irresponsibilities of their bankers.
So they're blaming the British and the Dutch rather than their own lack of regulation and their own...
They're blaming everybody, basically.
Everybody but themselves?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that the people running the government, they are leftists. They are hard-bitten, really sort of 70s-era socialists. And so they find themselves in the funny position of having to clean up, as they say, the neoliberal mess left by their predecessors. So they are sort of inclined to sort of point the fingers at the usual bad boys like IMF and greedy bankers and former colonial masters and imagined colonial masters. But they also recognize that it was the irresponsibility of their system that brought this all on. But again, they blame the other guys, and they say it's unfair that we have to pay all these guys back, and the international financial community says, well, that's too bad. I mean, you're a sovereign nation, and a responsibility of a sovereign nation is to take responsibility for your debts, and so that's where. But you know, as in all these situations, the politics gets very vitriolic, and I think there's still sort of a bemusement how this all could have happened, because it's not like a Singapore or Hong Kong. It's not where this furious animal spirits of capitalism is a sort of a natural thing there. It is a Nordic welfare state, and things just got dreadfully out of whack.
And it always struck me as a rather restrained place. Landon Thomas Jr. is financial correspondent for the New York Times. We're talking about the plans to try to save Iceland's economy as part of our underreported series. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the International Monetary Fund gave Iceland $4.6 billion in bailout money, and Britain and the Netherlands lent Iceland over $5 billion, and they're not grateful at all?
Well, it's actually two. The IMF gave two, and then combined Nordic companies or countries, it comes out to around four or five. No, I think they are grateful. I think it's just, you know, you get into one of those situations where rational thinking, it becomes a little bit of an endangered species, because the anger, frustration, and the sort of the difficult economic conditions are such that they have to lash out. And again, remember that they are all leftists. This is, I mean, pretty hardcore leftists, and then they find themselves where they have to work with the IMF and they have to work with bankers. And so I think that they are grateful, but they're angry at the same time, and a lot of it's politics. And so, you know, the finance minister, for example, will sort of say, "I've always disagreed with the IMF. I've always felt that they're bad people, the policemen of international capitalism. But we got to work with them." So I think you have to sort of feed some meat to the hardcore political constituency while sort of trying to be pragmatic at the same time.
To explain this political situation, we should probably backtrack a bit. In the wake of the financial crisis, Iceland's government collapsed in January, and then this new government, Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir, became prime minister. She's the leader of the socialists?
Yeah, it's a socialist.
And has she been able to do other things to help the country toward economic recovery?
Yeah, I mean, it's just funny. Iceland's one of these great places for a reporter where it's so small and so open, where you just walk right in and you meet minister after minister after parliamentarian, and they're all within a radius of about 200 yards. But she wasn't. She hasn't really been front and center on this, because, again, she came into this with absolutely no experience or interest or knowledge of economic affairs. So she's handed it off to her finance minister, who has in effect been running this whole operation. And so it's been his job to cobble together support and sort of to try to persuade people that you have to, it's okay to be angry, but Iceland has to dig itself out of this hole. And the first step is regaining the trust of international financial institutions, even if everyone is furious at how they got into this place, this situation in the first place. So it's really, in some ways, it's almost an educational process. They have to find, in effect, teach the people, and the people are so. I mean, it's a thriving democracy, one of the most has the highest literary rate of any country in the world. So everyone is so hyper focused and hyper sort of informed about this that it becomes a real sort of raging debate.
And for a recent article, you spoke to the country's health minister. He opposes the deal.
Yeah, no, and you know, he's happy to say it. And I think probably some of that is politics. Like, let's say, you know, to get out there and say it's bad. But yeah, that's how split the whole society is, and the government itself. And then you have the IMF in there, trying to sort of maintain a low profile, but people accuse the IMF of pulling, you know, say, of all these conspiracy theories of the IMF approving this cut or that cut, when in the end they're just trying to save this thing.
Well, the IMF is usually involved in countries that have less developed economies.
Right, and so that's a real, as the finance minister said, it's a trial for the IMF. Can the IMF come in and oversee a turnaround in a as I said, like a hyper aware and democratic country like this, because it's generally the programs are run in emerging nations where the political systems are less open, and it perhaps becomes a little bit easier to sort of push the process through. Here, everyone know, they call the IMF person there the governor of Iceland. He walks into a store and they say, "Ah, you're the IMF guy." And so it's every, you know, it's a country of 300,000 people, so everyone knows him, and it's so they're he's under a microscope, as is the IMF.
A lot of economists have described the situation in Iceland as Iceland needing to take its own medicine. But has anybody? Is there a possibility that they won't finally agree to the deal?
You know, I think generally in these types of situations, one finds that you never go to the worst case scenario. People always pull back, and so just like that, the economy, you know, the world economy, never truly collapsed. We never really truly entered a depression. I think in this situation, you won't see the sort of the popular view of they'll go and do something crazy and end up in oblivion. I think rational minds will pull through. There'll be some compromises, and the bill will go through, and they will pay it back, but it'll just be a long, hard slog.
Because they don't have much of a choice, actually.
I think, you know, in the end, they really don't. And the anger is that this agreement is supposedly unfair, and it does. You know, $5 billion is half the economy right there. And so, again, if you think about the U.S. or the U.K. having to sort of all of a sudden repay to foreigners one half of its economy and tax its citizens as a result of that, it's a huge, you know, it's hard to fathom because it's such a small economy. But, you know, if you look at how a situation like this would resonate in the U.S. and U.K., can you imagine how our Congress or the U.K. Parliament would react if it had to pay half of our GDP to China?
It's going to add to the country's debt burden to 200% of gross domestic product. On the other hand, that's still better than the economic situation immediately after the collapse. There were estimates that the country's debt was 850% of GDP.
Well, that was actually those were the bank assets. I don't think the debt itself got over there. But yeah, it is. It's, I think in the end, you're getting people, the rational minds in the end will say, look, it's bad, it's painful, it's awful, but this is the cost of our mistakes.
So what does it mean for the people of Iceland? Are they going to be cutbacks in health care? I know there's been a serious jump in unemployment.
Yeah, unemployment. This is usually a full employment economy. It's kind of like a little mini nirvana. The air is beautiful. The environment is pristine. Everyone has a job. Everyone's happy. The weather's great, at least in the summer. And now all of a sudden unemployment is 10%. People can't repay their loans because everything was tied. The krona, they had these local currency loans that were tied to Swiss franc and yen, and so when the currency collapsed by 100%, their debt doubled and their interest payments doubled. So while their salaries were decreasing, so it's been a huge adjustment. So you talk to people all the time. I can't pay my loan. I can't pay my mortgage. Gas prices are going up. It's a very expensive place because they have to import everything. So everything, you know, gas costs are very, very high, and everything is very expensive. So now it's more expensive, and so there's a real social pressure point, and that, you know, especially for a left-wing government, as this minister is saying, I have to cut expenditures 6% every year. I have to go in and close hospitals, and it's hard. So it's real frustration born from real sort of on the ground financial pain. But you know, it's happening to everyone.
Yeah, but Iceland has applied to join the European Union. Right. How would this situation affect its chances? And what about EU membership and the Icelandic currency, the krona? Would Iceland have to adopt the euro?
Well, there's a sense that perhaps if Iceland joined the EU and adopted the euro, that such a thing wouldn't happen again. And so I think that's where that sort of motivation is coming from. But the financials are their financial situation is so dire that it's almost a little bit silly to sort of think about joining the EU right now, because they don't meet any of the economic requirements with regard to budget deficits or anything. So they have a lot of work to do before they get there. But it's a very staunchly independent country, and it's always, I think, been wary about joining European clubs, and like other Nordic nations, it's prided it in its own independence. But I think there's a view that now that, well, what did independence do for us? It almost blew us up. So,
and there would be more regulation if they were a member of the EU.
And that's the essence of the fault here: is that that banking sector was just not regulated. As everyone will tell you, there is a neoliberal. Neoliberal is the worst epithet one can hurl at anyone these days in Reykjavik. But it was a neoliberal government that was very pro-regulation, and banks were led to do whatever they wanted to do. And so that's all going to change. And yeah, I think in the EU there probably would be more restraints. They certainly, if they have to tie their economic policy to the euro, there would be more restrictions. But you know, it's sort of looking down the road. But in the end, if they don't sign this deal, and if they're sort of exiled by the financial community, there's no hope of getting into the EU.
And even then, it doesn't look all that likely, saying, in the near future. The IMF has been able to have a fairly free hand in the countries that they've worked in. Are they frustrated by the resistance that they've experienced in Iceland?
When you talk to the IMF people there, they actually give credit to the politicians there for being quite brave. Again, a leftist finance minister having to sit down with the IMF is not a natural thing, and so they give credit to the government, and they say that they're on target so far with regard to budget cuts and that kind of thing, but they're very insistent on high interest rates.
Go ahead.
And keeping the currency stable. But that's a sort of the controversial part. But I think they're willing to support the government as far as to see what they can do.
Landon Thomas Jr. is financial correspondent for the New York Times. We've been talking to him in London as part of our underreported series. We've been talking about what's happening in Iceland as a result of the terrible crisis, the October 2008 crash that was tied to pretty much three banks, but has had an impact all throughout Europe. I think the British and the Dutch are particularly angry with Iceland right now because so many people have lost money.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, they passed an anti-terrorist law initially in October to freeze the assets. So it really became, ministers were having very, very nasty conversations with each other over the phone. So there was no love lost between Iceland and the UK because everyone was angry, rightfully so. I mean, UK was angry at the irresponsibilities of Icelandic bankers, and Icelanders were angry at being called terrorists by Gordon Brown. So it really was a deeply sort of resentful time on both sides.
Landon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.